Welcome to Staying Power, a show that is all about resilience. What it is, what it isn't, what to do if we want more of it, what to do if we realize we don't have as much of it as we would like. Whatever the case might be for you, in the end, resilience is a choice. Here once again to join me to discuss our ideas and experiences in helping people from around the world develop more resilience in their lives is my friend, my colleague, my co-author, my co-lots of things in this realm, Tawny Santabria. Tawny, how's it going?
It is going well. It's good. Lots going on.
Yeah. Same here. So it's good to have you on the line again to talk again about all the different ways we can develop resilience in our lives, which, you know, it seems to be something that you hear a lot about lately, right? And it's one reason why we do this show is that, you know, there's people talking about it. And one of the things that I love about this show is that there's so many stories that we can talk about and that we can dig into that illustrate this. And so with that, I'm going to jump into this one with a question. Are you a person who likes to go on cruises?
I would have to say I don't know because I've never been on one.
Me neither.
But I'm about to go on one later in the year, so I'll get back to you.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'll be interested what you think. It's not something that I've ever really been drawn to. I think doing the Alaska one that goes up the Inside Passage to Alaska, I think would be great. I've seen too many movies, I think is part of the problem with those things. But nevertheless, I asked that for a reason because the story I have today, this resilience story that I think touches on a number of different things. And I'll be interested to see what comes up for you as opposed to what came up for me, has to do in some ways with seafaring or with cruises. But it's focused on a woman, and it's a historical story. A woman named Violet Jessup. Okay, so Violet Jessup, she was born in 1887 in Argentina, and she was the daughter of Irish immigrants, the oldest of 9 children, and 6 of them survived. You know, in the end, I mean, their family moved from Ireland as immigrants, very poor. And but so she was the oldest, taking care of a lot of younger siblings as she was growing up. And a lot of challenges, obviously, younger siblings dying. And then when she was 16, her father died after complications in surgery. And so this was her childhood was dominated by raising kids, going to school, supporting the family, and then at age 16, losing her father. And so in response to that, her mother moved the family back across the Atlantic to England. And her mother took a job as a ship stewardess for cruise lines, which of course at the time, this is in the turn of the 20th century, was the primary mode of travel across the world, these big ocean liners. So companies like the White Star Line, Cunard, the Red Star Line, these were sort of like how airlines are today, right? These were the big names. And it wasn't easy to travel. You had to have a lot of money to do these types of things or be lucky enough to get a ticket. So while Violet continued to go to school, her mother became what they called a stewardess at the time on cruise ships and ended up sailing all over the world. Well, not long after they moved, around 1910, her mother got sick and could no longer work to support the family. And so Violet went to sea to do the same job that her mother did. So she became a stewardess. In fact, when she was hired by the White Star Line company, they told her that she needed to dress down a little bit because she was too attractive. They were worried that, you know, her working on ships was going to cause a ruckus by, you know, so she had to actively dress down. And she was also very interested in, developing medical skills. Obviously, she'd been helping raise her family. And so she also became a nurse. And so she could combine both of those things together. And so she went to work for the White Star Line in 1910. And in 1911, she was on board the RMS Olympic, which was at the time the biggest cruise ship in the world. And on her first voyage, the Olympic was sailing out of harbor in England and rammed into a British warship. And both ships managed to survive and got back to port. Nobody was hurt or anything like that, but not exactly the most auspicious beginning to, you know, a career at sea. And she could actually do quite well at this. This was something you could be paid quite well to do if you were good at this job. And so for her, it was important to do it. So she survived that. They switched her over to another ship in the White Star Line, and she began to sail mainly across the Atlantic between England and North America. In 1912, though, in April, because she was so good of her job, she was moved over to another ship in the White Star Line that was making its inaugural voyage, the RMS Titanic. And of course, we know how that ended, right? Now, she was a stewardess on this ship, and 4 days after it sailed, of course, everybody knows the story, the ship hit an iceberg and over a course of 2.5 hours sank. She survived. She was in lifeboat number 16, and she was, because she spoke fluent Spanish, and there were a number of people on the ship who did not speak English, she was pushed by the owners of the ship to be an example to the non-English speakers of what they needed to do to get off the ship. And so she was brought forward to be this model of that. She showed them how to put on life vests and all that kind of stuff. And then she was put onto lifeboat 16, and somebody handed her a little baby. And she took that. And so she was out, you know, with the other lifeboats, saw the Titanic sink and all the horrors that went with that, right? And they were picked up by the Carpathia. And when she got on board, the baby's mother actually came and found the baby. The mother had survived miraculously. And she never really heard anything about that ever again. But that became this story that for a little while had made the rounds in the newspapers as there were recounts of all this. So now, interestingly enough, there were a lot of people who survived the Titanic disaster who never went back to sea, right? Either to sail or to work, and for understandable reasons. Not her, not Violet. As soon as she was able to get back to England, she applied to move to another ship, and eventually she was moved around a little bit. And then when World War I started a couple years later, 1914, she was assigned to a hospital ship since she had nurse training. She was assigned to a hospital ship, the RMS Britannic, which was the sister ship of the Titanic. So the exact same size, exact same thing, which must have been somewhat surreal, I would think. And so she served on board that ship for 2 years. And it was in the Aegean Sea, off the coast of Greece, between Greece and Italy. And in 1916, it was a hospital ship, so it wasn't supposed to be under fire or anything like that. It hit a mine in a harbor, a German mine, and it blew a hole in the side of the ship, and the ship began to sink. And it was sinking fast. The Titanic sank in 2.5 hours. The Britannic sank in about 20 minutes. And she managed to get into a lifeboat, but had to bail out of the lifeboat when it was dropped almost directly over the propellers that were still spinning. They couldn't turn them off. And so she jumped out of the lifeboat, managed to avoid the propellers, but the suction of the ship pulled her under, and she hit her head against the hull of the ship and somehow managed to keep consciousness and somehow popped up above the waves and wasn't sucked down with the ship. And so she survived it, but with a pretty traumatic head injury. So this woman, who as the story became bigger and people connected the dots, started to be called the most unlucky woman in the world, they in newspapers and things like this, managed to survive this. And when the war was over and she'd recovered enough from this in 1920, she went back to sea and worked as a nurse and a stewardess for the next 30 years. She left the White Star Line, which I don't blame her. 3 times and you're out, right? And so she ended up with the Red Star Line, but she ended up having this illustrious career at sea. And in her memoirs that she wrote, when somebody mentioned, or when she was asked about this most unlucky, being the unluckiest person alive, she said something to the effect of, "It's all how you look at it. I also could be the luckiest person alive." And so she ended up dying in 1971. But she spent her entire career doing what first her mom had done, and then she ended up doing, despite 3 very harrowing experiences, each one seemingly for her personally tougher than the other on her own body, but continued. And I just thought that was a interesting story to share today, particularly around that notion of luck and lucky and those types of things. But then also all the questions that came up for me, like, wow, what are all the different ingredients in who she was, the choices she made? And what does that tell us about now? Obviously, you can find her looking her up pretty easily, and people find that interesting. But it seems to me there's a lot we can examine ourselves from a story like this. What do you think?
Well, I was thinking she was actually the luckiest person in the world, is what I was thinking when you said she was the unluckiest. Mm-hmm. So it's very interesting on how we frame our experiences. And there was something about her that felt enough luck in that she survived all of those, that there was like, okay, if I can survive these, I can survive whatever it brings.
Yeah.
Right. So there's that, that's a more resilient sort of mindset, mm-hmm. as opposed to, oh my gosh, I'm doomed. The next one's going to be worse.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I think back then in those days, being in a job that would help you, would allow you to do what you enjoy doing, mm-hmm. and also make pretty good money, to be able to, you know, provide for family and all the rest. She probably did feel probably in some regard pretty lucky.
Oh yeah. Yeah. How could she not? You know, and it's to me, it's so interesting because I think what stands out to me too is the response that people have had ever since of, yes, calling her the most unlucky woman, but it's standing out that she made this choice. The choices to me make sense why she would go back if she chose to frame it that way as being lucky rather than unlucky.
Well, for sure. I think that if we give up on things just because we've experienced a hardship around it, mm-hmm. and I don't mean to minimize her experiences, but certainly how she understood her experiences were enough to allow her and she wanted to continue to do this. So again, we're coming from a perspective of not wanting her to have a different perspective, but she already had that perspective going, mm-hmm. in that sense. Right. So if we give up on things that are difficult for us, then what?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's very limiting if we do, right? If we do. And I couldn't help but think when I was thinking contextually about this story, you know, as a young child, you know, she was already faced a lot of responsibility, had already seen a lot of hardship. These were things that were markers in her life. And then, of course, she sailed back across the ocean back to England. And an important part of that in her memoirs, I looked up and read excerpts of it, she loved it. She loved the feeling of not only being at sea, but the adventure of it. There's a romanticism. Certainly at the time, it was, you know, intensely romantic, right? This idea of traveling the world by sea. And then also out of necessity, right? She had to help her family by taking that job. And it was a job that her mom already knew how to do, that she could do herself. And you get the sense that she saw it as a way, based on both her experience and what she wanted to do in life, to really go and see the world and provide for her family. You get the sense that she saw it as the best possible series of options for her and her family.
Oh, sure. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, if there's some sort of enjoyment in what you're doing, then you're going to be, you're willing to kind of move through the hard parts. Mm-hmm. That's the key. If she hadn't had any enjoyment, she probably would have not continued.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So when we love something, I mean, a lot of people love what they're doing and they're very risky, kinds of scary, like people, mm-hmm. who climb the sides of mountains.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I have no interest in that.
Interest
That's
in that.
Not going to be me.
That was going to be my next question.
So, you know, lots of, when we enjoy something, we're willing to sort of risk, mm-hmm. that difficulty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it seems to me too that you know, and I'm no expert in this, and maybe you have some thoughts on this, but it seems that, and it would be an important thing after a difficult thing like that, whether, you know, that's very dramatic, of course, right? Three of the biggest, you know, three big accidents at sea, two of them world famous. But even anything like if we have a negative experience like being in a car accident or something difficult like that, it'd be important to, seems to me, to get back in a car, right? You know, is there something to that, that the idea of going through something tough and then putting yourself back in a situation that may not end that way because it was an accident would be an important thing to do? Is that a real thing?
It keeps you from being fearful of the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so, but then it's a choice. So, certainly if you're afraid to get back into a car, you're going to be really limited in your day to day. But if you were in a plane and you had a situation happen on a plane, you didn't want to get back in the plane for the rest of your life, I would say probably maybe you don't have to, if you don't want to, right? Like you can still live and not have to deal with that. Mm-hmm. I've had a few clients over the years who were nurses on the helicopters. So, I'm forgetting the name of the, but it's local. So, you know, the helicopters where they, you know, come in and they take people to the major hospitals and things like that. Oh, okay. And they've had a few things happen on those. Mm-hmm. They were very, very frightening and scary. And some went back on and some didn't.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So that's the part is, you know, I wouldn't want to say that you have to always get back on the horse, because there's lots of things where you could make that choice, but certainly there's going to be a fear attached to that thing if we don't experience it again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And that's, I think part of that whole paradox or tension is sort of what fascinated me about this, because it would be, depending on the circumstance and what we're talking about, it would be hard to fault somebody for not, you know, for not getting back on a helicopter, not getting back on a plane, or not getting back on a boat. From the point of view of developing resilience, obviously, whatever choice people make, you know, they're going to be those challenges, right? Of continuing, you know, if you're going to build resilience, it's going to look a little different for people who are making different choices. So I was fascinated by that. Like if she didn't do that, what would she have needed to know or think about or appreciate or be aware of if she was going to be building her own resilience, had she made a different choice? There's no way to know that, but I was just wondering.
Yeah. Yeah. And who's to say also that if she might have built resilience in other areas of her life, just because we don't go back to the thing doesn't mean that we're not a resilient person.
Right.
We could be making a pretty aware choice around not exposing ourselves to the thing anymore, or, you know, getting back on the horse. We could be making a pretty aware choice, and maybe not doing it is, there's some resiliency in that because you've got, you know, I don't know, children to raise or something like this that might be, you know, okay, giving you some perspective here. So I don't want to make a judgment of like, if you don't move through in a particular way, then you're not building resiliency, because that we can't know all of the circumstances that's going on in somebody's life. But certainly if we're afraid of a lot of things and we live life in ways that are really protected for ourselves, where we don't engage in things outside of our comfort zone anymore, then that could be quite limiting. And I wouldn't think that somebody in that situation would be very satisfied in their life.
Yeah. 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 So it might be a larger pattern if there's a lot of things that cause fear that prevent from engaging or that are limiting, that keep you separated or keep you out of something. That's a larger question than just making a choice around one thing. That might be a really real thing, right? Being in an aircraft accident or a car accident or in this case, a ship accident.
Oh, sure. Like our life has lots and lots and lots of layers. Mm-hmm. So to boil it down to one thing isn't fair to any of us.
Mm-hmm.
So we, you know, if we can continue to look in more of the larger sphere in our perspective, right, then we're going to actually have a little bit more clarity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we make a judgment off of one particular action, and we do this all of the time, we make a judgment around it. And then the person is just that, right? Good, bad, or ugly.
Yeah.
The person is just that. Oh, it's so amazing because they did this thing.
Right.
Well, the rest of their life could not be so amazing for a lot of different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So we jump to making things all or nothing. And so, so just continuing to keep that in mind, that there's a lot of different layers to a person's life, mm-hmm. and judging one action isn't going to give us any clarity at all.
Yeah. And it got me wondering, you know, if, she's notable, Violet Jessup is, because of this, right? These three things that happened. She also had a little bit of notoriety from the Titanic accident because, you know, her story went around the world. By the way, just really quickly, in almost every dramatic reenactment of the Titanic on film, there's somebody who plays her role in a really small role. In the Titanic film that James Cameron did, she's the woman that an actor went up to and said, please put this on, set a good example for everybody. So she kind of had like a 15 minutes of fame out of it. But there were a lot of other people. There were stewardesses, stewards who survived, who never went back to sea, right? Some who did go back to sea. But the ones who didn't, no one ever necessarily wrote anything about them, right? It cuts back to exactly what you just said, right? It's there's a risk in elevating something as proof that this person is more resilient than someone else because of this one thing when there's so many of those other layers. That's what I was thinking about. I appreciate the language you put to that because that's what I was wondering as I was reading all this. What about the people who went through the exact same thing and made a different choice? That doesn't make them less resilient necessarily.
We love a good story.
Uh-huh.
The media loves a good story.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's not a true story. In this case, it's a true story, but even if it's not a true story, they love a good story.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to keep our perspective about ourselves. Mm-hmm. If we don't want to get us swept up in all the madness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I don't think any of us, I was thinking about it myself. I know for me, I would never want to be either known or labeled or judged for one thing, right, in my life. Either, you know, some big thing that I did wouldn't be some indicator of who I was as a person, and some big failure that I had, I wouldn't want to be defined around either. And so she even wrote about this in her memoirs. You know, she said she ended up writing the memoirs because so many people were telling her she should, and it was such a unique story she had to tell. But she did reference multiple times, said there were a lot of people, a lot of stories on these ships, and the people who didn't survive, their stories are much more worth knowing about and hearing about, at least to her, than her own. And so she even felt some ambivalence about being known for all of these things, rather than the fact that she had, for example, a really successful 30-year career after World War I was over doing this job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's all about, the boring parts don't get told, right? The mundane doesn't get told. Mm-hmm. And so the problem with that is we're always looking in our own lives then to make it like that we can't enjoy what's not being like applauded by everybody.
Right.
We can't enjoy those parts of our life. And those parts of our life make up the bulk of our life typically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they do. And those are the things that day in, day out are the things that really those were what illuminate our growth, that we knit our whole lives together around. And having one thing like this, as notable as they are, as these types of things tend to be, is so limiting in that sense. And she's not the only one to say that. I mean, almost anybody who's got notoriety for some of this would tend to in situations like this, look at these things and write about them with a little bit of embarrassment on some of these things, or frustration that in her case, that this was really what everybody wanted to talk about. You know, it was not so much everything else. And even just look at the way I presented the story, right? I mean, the reason we know the story is because she went through these things, not because of anything else, right, about her. And everything else is ancillary in the retelling to these things in her story. It's just an interesting mm-hmm. way we pigeonhole things.
And, well, yeah. I mean, nobody wants to listen to something that's not stimulating. I mean, they really don't.
It's true. It's true.
So, and so that's okay, mm-hmm. right? That's okay. But if we're wanting to kind of think past that and experience our lives with greater depth, and meaning, then we want to be able to look at the whole of something too.
Yeah. Yeah.
That I guess we kind of got off track a little bit, but so again, not to minimize any of her life story at all.
Sure.
But yeah, but you didn't start out with the story saying, okay, we're going to talk about a woman who spent 30 years on a cruise ship.
Yep. That's exactly right.
Right. You didn't start out the story that way.
Nope. And that's not how I found the story. Yeah.
Totally. And you use the names, the bigger names, mm-hmm. right? To get people sort of like, oh, I've heard this before. Let me hear some more.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Trying to grab attention.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. And that's just the way that goes. You know, no judgment. It's just the way that goes and the way our brains work. We want to like get keyed up on, ooh, that's interesting. Let me pay mm-hmm. attention now.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. And, you know, and that's one of the challenges too, in looking into, you know, historical stories tend to be historical in note and written down for reasons. Oftentimes they stand out against the norm, that type of thing, which is why, you know, one of the reasons why we've started asking listeners, so that means you listeners, to share stories of resilience that you have and that you know of, and ones that, because there's a lot of resilience in everyday life. In fact, everyday life, the day in, day out, the mundane, the stuff that we tend to consider boring or repetitive, there's a lot of resilience that can be revealed in that too. And those sometimes are really hard to find when you're looking for historical stories, right? It's a challenge in that sense, which is why we'd love to hear from listeners stories of resilience that are familiar to you. And certainly we could bring those on and talk about those for those very reasons, Tawny. Be interesting to explore a story of somebody who just had a, you know, from start to finish, a day in, day out life.
Those are my favorite. I love the boring stories because there's so much meaning in the boring stories that we overlook. I mm-hmm. love hearing a boring story and really being able to, you know, talk about the gold in it. There is so much gold in the mundane.
There is.
So.
There is. And so with that, as we wrap up this episode of Staying Power, we again ask, if you have a story, but you're wondering, that's maybe too boring. Guess what? It's not. We don't believe that here. So, and Tawny just said so eloquently. So send us those. You can send those stories or information about them at our email address, stayingpowershow@gmail.com. You can also join our Patreon project site, which is connected. That link is with the show notes. And you can join there and you can let us know those stories there. And we'd love to hear them. So thank you so much for listening to this episode of Staying Power. Remember, you can get this as a podcast wherever you get your podcast. Thank you for subscribing, for reviewing, and for sharing it with your friends, your family, and your social networks. We greatly appreciate it. We'll be back next week with another story to tell about resilience. Thank you, Tawny. Until then, I am JDK Winnikin.
And I'm Tawny Santabria.
We will see you soon, everybody.